support the station that supports the communities of Bristol and contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community.
The worst present I probably ever got would be one of those knitting machine jumpers, purple and blue with rabbits on the front. Oh my goodness.
Happy Christmas, Bristol.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Did Prime Minister David Cameron illegally sell South African nukes on the black market before he became an MP? We ask, how far will politicians go these days to raise cash to fight an election? And we explore the evidence which surfaced this year and look at the corrupting global arms deal influence of BAE Systems. Yes, there's Middle East mayhem with massive coordinated bomb attacks in Iraq and Syria this week too. And with BBC Radio Bristol's listener figures falling off a cliff, Rajar, the listener figure company, announced in October that Radio Bristol lost half their listeners since October 2010. We asked, has the station lost its way? And what about the wider BBC, with cuts of about 20% or so being implemented, largely because of Rupert Murdoch's News International lobbied that the BBC was unfair competition? Is the national BBC also wondering where to go? We hear from former Tory Minister, European Commissioner, now Chair of the BBC Trust, Chris Patten, and the BBC Director General, Mark Thompson. Plus, the Fox Werity scandal that led to North Somerset MP and Defence Secretary Liam Fox being forced to resign earlier this year. Who is Werity, and what's the connection with the British ambassador to Israel, Philip Gould? But first, Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party has just been re-elected, but with a reduced majority. Martin, is the writing on the wall, do you think, for Putin and Medvedev and their game of musical chairs with the presidency and the prime ministership?
No. Basically, it's what you might expect. They've got economic problems in Russia, as they have elsewhere. United Russia has dropped a large percentage of its previous vote, but it used to have a two-thirds majority in the Duma. It's now the largest single party, and they've lost some seats, and the communists have gained some seats. Incidentally, the people that the West are backing, Nemtsov and so on, didn't even reach 7%. So the West constantly misrepresents politics in Russia. Putin still has a great degree of support. Medvedev is now coming closer to Putin because of the West's rather hostile attitude. Medvedev was being tempted towards the Western point of view, but the sighting of missiles in Poland and Romania and the falling out over Libya and Syria, Medvedev is now close to Putin, and United Russia is still the biggest, strongest party in Russia. But because it's a democratic country, unlike, say, you know, Honduras or maybe the United States, and United Russia hasn't got as big a majority as it used to have, but it still has the majority. And that's what the Western media just refuse to accept.
Well, last week, Vladimir Putin gave a 4.5-hour live TV discussion with a whole load of journalists and members of the public asking him questions. I mean, this is quite unprecedented. We don't have that sort of thing here. We have short press conferences, but certainly not ranging over such a wider subject, Martin.
Listen, I'm not based in Russia. I did visit in the 90s when I was working in the region. I wouldn't presume to speak on behalf of ordinary Russians. But if you look at the opinion, you know, the final result of the poll, United Russia is still the biggest party. Their closest rivals are the communists on 20%. They've gone up in the poll. So in other words, if Putin was to fall, it would be the communists and Zyuganov who would gain from that. And then the West's little protégés are way, way behind. And of course, they're presented in the West like Korzakovsky, who's in prison, and Nemtsov, and others from the sort of free market right of Russian politics. But they haven't got any popular support. Putin, in fact, is a centrist in Russian political terms.
Well, let's have a listen now to a little extract from Putin's TV debate, where he talks about Afghanistan, which of course is really rather close to Russia. And also, the Russians are now allowing NATO to actually use Russian territory to ferry supplies to their rather looking increasingly isolated troops, the British and American and the NATO force there. So let's have a listen now to Vladimir Putin and his television address.
You know, they made up their mind on Afghanistan, but did they discuss the mission with their allies in advance? Hell no. They carried out their strike and only then started pulling in other forces, saying, whoever's not with us is against us. We'd like to be allies with the United States, but what I see now is not partnership. Sometimes I think America doesn't need allies, it needs servants.
Now that's Vladimir Putin speaking on Russian TV and a TV address last week. Martin, he's sounding a little bit bitter and twisted there. The Americans want servants.
Well, everybody's getting rather fed up with the Western oligarchy. We've managed to crash the international financial system, seem addicted to invading and attacking other countries and destabilising their politics. And the Chinese and the Russians are basically looking for a constructive, stable relationship with the Western powers, but they don't feel that they can
trust
them.
But you're saying that, but actually what's been going on in the Middle East is not really... I mean, OK, in Libya, that NATO came in to assist, but the rest of the countries, this is spontaneous uprisings from the ground.
Well, I mean, we could discuss that in a moment, whether... how spontaneous these uprisings may or may not be, but the fact of the matter is that Russia and China both abstained over the no-fly zone over Libya. They said, okay, you say it's a humanitarian mission, we will abstain. But they saw the West basically abusing the UN resolution that they'd got for a complete regime change attack on Libya, and that was perceived as a threat by both the Russians and the Chinese. Don't forget the Chinese lost a massive investment that they've made in Libyan oil industry. They've lost all of that now. And therefore, they're 30,000 of their people were working in Libya and had to be removed. That's a real attack on China's national interests.
Well, one of the most horrendous things about Libya, of course, was the way that Colonel Gaddafi himself was killed, and the fact that he didn't get in any way some kind of fair trial, which doesn't really bode well for the future, does it?
No, but and as I've said before on this programme, if that's okay, then when we get hold of the King of Saudi Arabia and the King of Bahrain, they too will have to be sodomised with a bayonet and shot through the head. It's bloody revolution all the way. We've got, you know, the Western powers have now decided they like bloody revolution. Like in Egypt, of course, if the people go out and fight the army in Egypt, as they probably will do, the RAF will come in and bomb the tanks, won't they? Now, of course, the Palestinians, there's no point talking to the Israelis. It's quite obvious. The only way you get anything in Syria, in Palestine, in any of these countries, is you've got to rise up and you've got to take the bloodshed. It's got to be bloody revolution all the way. Never mind negotiations. Gaddafi and his ilk and all of the pro-Western people, they too are going to be put up against a wall and shot. That is the logic of the British government's position. And of course, that is a logic of a total war in the Middle East. Don't go crying for your mummy when you get it, is all I can say to the people in charge.
Well, let's at least go back to Russia for a minute and have another listen to Putin and his address. Because, I mean, it still is an important power, Russia.
Yes, they've got nuclear weapons.
So let's see what he had to say in his address. I've taken a few extracts, so here's another one.
Vlast magazine published a photo of a ballot that had an obscene message addressed to you on it. I would not want to voice it right now.
Why not? Go ahead.
Putin, why don't you... The rest is unbroadcastable.
Yes, I've seen that message. I found it very amusing. And I was even pleased because there's nothing new in this attitude. I saw plenty of dirt thrown my way when I was president, but I did not doubt myself then, nor do I doubt my actions now. As far as I know, the message on that ballot was written in London, and we know very well why some Russians live there and why they don't want to come back. Their obscene message to me simply tells me how much they want to come back, but they can't while I'm in power. I'm not mad at them. I'm actually grateful that they came and voted.
Well, I mean, Putin came to power in 1999 as a result of the bombings in Moscow, all covered in Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia. And at that stage, he was working with the oligarchy, with Berezovsky, who's got political asylum over here. And basically, it was a false flag terrorist attack, a bit like 9/11. They killed a lot of working class people in Moscow and Ryazan. They blamed the Chechens. And that kept the Communist Party out. There was about to be a November ballot, which Zyuganov and the Communist Party were about to win because the Russian economy had collapsed. Putin was brought in by the oligarchy to fix the election. He did, as a result of his false flag attacks. But of course then Putin double-crossed the oligarchy, and he's part of what's called in Russia the Siloviki, that is to say the security apparatus. And they were brought in by the oligarchs to keep the communists out, but then they rebelled against the oligarchy, and Putin basically put himself in power. And the oligarchs are still in power in Russia as long as they work within the Russian national interest, which is what Putin sees himself as representing.
I mean, he's hinting there that Boris Berezovsky in London is still working from behind the scenes to try and influence Russian politics.
Berezovsky is a very interesting character. He's the kind of Rupert Murdoch of Russian politics, and he basically got Putin. He was the one who basically chose Putin to be the enforcer for the oligarchy, and then they fell out. And Berezovsky, very interesting character. He's been best friends with Putin, and then fell out with him. And one of the things Berezovsky said: Putin bombed Moscow in 1999. I know because I helped him did it. Now give me political asylum, and he's got political asylum. But of course, he's been best friends with Cheney as well now. So he's a very interesting transitional character, having been best friends with the top Russian gangsters and best friends with the top Western gangsters. And he lives in Britain because we're at the centre of it all.
Well, final clip from Vladimir Putin and his 4.5-hour Russian TV debate, discussion, interview, whatever you want to call it, is actually looking at the about a tweet which was sent out by McCain, the Republican presidential candidate for the last elections, in which apparently he's referring to Russia as possibly going the same way as Libya in the future. In a way, it's a kind of veiled threat. So let's have a listen to that.
Your friend, US Senator John McCain, has said on Twitter that you could follow the fate of Muammar Gaddafi. Do you think it's an idle threat or a real plan by the West?
Well, calling him a friend is probably an exaggeration. Although I have met Mr. McCain, I think it was at that memorable Munich Security Conference 4 years ago. Yes, I've seen that statement. What can I say? First, his words weren't meant for me, but for all of Russia. Some countries would want Russia to step aside, to get out of the way, and stop interfering in the ruling of the world. They're still afraid of our nuclear potential. That's why Russia is always in the spotlight. That's why it's a pain in the neck for many. We have an independent foreign policy, and I hope it stays this way in the future. Of course, that's not very convenient for some people. Second, the West is not monolithic, and we do have more friends than enemies. Third, Mr. McCain is known to have fought in Vietnam. I believe he has enough civilian blood on his hands. Is it that he can't live without such horrible, disgusting sights as the butchering of Gaddafi? The whole world saw him being killed, all bloodied. Is that democracy? And who did it? Drones, including American ones, delivered a strike on his motorcade. Then commandos, who were not supposed to be there, brought in so-called opposition and militants, and killed him without trial. I'm not saying that Gaddafi didn't have to quit, but that should have been left up to the people of Libya to decide through the democratic process. It's a long and difficult way, but it's the only way to do it right. Mr. McCain was taken prisoner in Vietnam and was put not just in jail, but in a pit. He sat there for several years. Anyone would go nuts after that.
Well, I think Putin sounds the reasonable one there, doesn't he? It's the West, if you look at the Republican candidates, not just McCain, they're coming out with all sorts of nonsense about how they're going to go to war with Iran, China, Russia. And of course the Iranians, the Chinese and the Russians are listening to this, and maybe they're just saying this to get elected, but it's bound to make them a bit worried when people are saying stuff like that. What if Putin was saying, well, we're going to have to go to war with the West, there's nothing else to be done? He's not saying that. He's trying to play it cool. He's a cool customer.
What about his accusation there that it was US drones that initially attacked Gaddafi's convoy, who was apparently, he was travelling out, wasn't he, under the out of Sirte, under a white flag?
And yes, and it was knocked out by the RAF, nobody knows. And as they said, commandos were on the ground from Qatar and the British SAS, and they weren't supposed to be there because it was supposed to be the Libyans sorting this out. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group been working with MI6 for years. The Russian general staff gave a press conference, said there was no evidence whatsoever of airstrikes against civilian demonstrators. You see, the Syrians are not using airstrikes against civilian demonstrators, they're using tanks and machine guns, and they're making sure that they don't use airstrikes so that the West got no excuse for a no-fly zone. But if they did try and put a no-fly zone over Syria, the Russian Navy have got an aircraft carrier there already to resist it. Can you see how dangerous all of this is? Nobody can actually stop what's happening in Syria now, even if they wanted to, and it's going to pull in all the neighbouring countries, and you could have a general conflagration just like that over Christmas. Why not?
Well, that's a little bit worrying. But what do you think overall? I mean, you know, what's been happening is there's been an attempt to sort of compare the Russians and I mean to what's been going on in Libya, etc., by McCain. But ultimately, do you think that the Russian elections really are free and fair? Because there have been questions
raised.
Well,
they're as free and fair as the ones in the United States of America, where people get bumped off and the electronic voting machines are fiddled with. They're as free and fair as we've seen in Honduras, where the elected government has been bumped out by the United States in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, the idea that Russia is not a democratic society, but then this isn't a democratic society. There are vested interests pulling strings behind the scenes in Moscow, in Britain, and in the United States, and they're no more or less democratic than we are. That was a free and fair election in the Western sense of the word, and Putin won it, although, of course, he tried to rig it, as no doubt, you know, the conservative condemned government will try and do here by rigging the constituencies as they're intending to do. I mean, what's a democracy? I mean, at what point do you actually say we're not going to talk to you because we don't? There is no sense at all in Putin has clearly got the biggest support of any politician in the country of Russia. Nobody else even comes close. So to try and just get rid of him because we don't like what he's saying is just idiotic.
Happy Christmas or happy holidays, however you're celebrating at this time of year. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
There we are. That's one of our Christmas jingles. Now, did Prime Minister David Cameron illegally sell South African nuclear weapons on the black market before he became an MP? We ask, how far will politicians go these days to raise cash to fight an election and explore some evidence which surfaced this year looking at the corrupting global arms deal as well, the influence of BAE Systems? Now, Martin, this is a persistent rumour circulating on the internet. Why is it that we're actually talking about it here this evening? Because it does actually look as if there may be some evidence for this, some reasonably strong evidence.
Well, as you know, Tony, both you and I are in contact with the source of this rumour, if that's what you want to call it. If people want to check out this rumour, they should go to Veterans Today on the internet and check out the stuff from Gordon Duff, who's the senior editor of Veterans Today.
This is a US site.
It's a US magazine for people, and it's on the internet for people who've served in the US Armed Forces. And Gordon Duff is an ex-US Marine. He's in a wheelchair, and he's the senior editor of Veterans Today. And he has covered this story in depth, but I know for a fact that the information he's using is the same information that we are getting about this particular sequence of events.
But, I mean, I'm not really interested in a rumour unless there's some evidence to back it up. So what evidence is
there? Well, the evidence to back it up, for example, is that Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, in Hansard, he asked the Tory front bench when the Tories were in power...
when are we talking about?
We're talking about the 1990s here. And he said, where did you get that £17.8 million, which the rumour is that... let me just explain what a bit basically just run people through what happened in South Africa in the late 80s, early 90s. There was about to be a transition to black majority rule. The South Africans had developed 10 nuclear warheads with the help of the Israelis. They then offered to sell those 10 nuclear warheads, 6 to the Americans, 4 to the British. The British agreed to buy them, but a private institution set itself up to interpose itself between the British and Arms Corps. It was Astra Holdings, part of Astra Fireworks, headed up by a former MI6 officer called Stephen Kok.
Okay, so first of all, sorry to stop you there, but Arms Corps, who were they?
Arms Corps were the South African military company, which did all of their military stuff, including nuclear weapons, at Pelindaba. So the British agreed to buy 4 of these nuclear warheads, but at the same time, it wasn't the British government that actually stumped up the money. It was a consortium of top Tory businessmen, including named William Waldegrave, Michael Heseltine.
Oh, he's a local lad, isn't
yes,
he,
indeed.
Mr. Waldegrave.
And apparently, a lot of this goes on in the Mendips. That's where a lot of these people are based. And so they bought these nuclear warheads, 4 of them, and the deal was set up by a visit to South Africa by 3 individuals. Sir Kenneth Warren, who was head of the DTI Trade and Industry Committee, he was a Tory MP. Dr. David Kelly, representing the British Civil Service as Britain's top weapons person.
But he was working, I imagine, at Porton Down at the time, the chemical biological weapons.
And the third person on this little delegation was David Cameron when he was working at Tory Central Office. And they basically fixed the deal. And the deal was that these Tory fundraisers and top grandees would put up the money to buy these nuclear weapons, which would then be sold onto the British government at a profit to the private consortium based around Astra Holdings. And the British government eventually paid 50 million quid for these weapons, but John Bredenkamp, who's an arms dealer based in Zimbabwe, double-crossed the Astra Holdings consortium. And once he got the 50 million quid, he then Dr. David Kelly was sent out to Oman in the Middle East, where these weapons were being held, to check that they were there, and found that Bredon Camp had sold them on. And of course, this was an illegal deal, so there's absolutely no way that any of the top Tories involved in the deal could say anything about it. And the Tory party itself got £17.8 million for its 1992 election campaign. General Wildboar Smith, their chief treasurer, turned up at central office with a £17.8 million cheque from the Bank of Jersey. That is what we're being told. Now, if you actually check in Hansard, Doug Hoyle did indeed ask the Tory party where they got that £17.8 million. He never got a satisfactory answer. He'd been tipped off by Tara Biggs-Davidson, who was actually part of the cabal that was doing this, but at a very lowly level. She was a kind of secretarial level, and she'd actually photocopied quite a lot of the documents, which is why they ended up in the hands of Doug
Hoyle. Well, the obvious question, Martin, if I can just sort of try and pull what you're saying apart, is if these nuclear weapons were lost, how come the Tory party still allegedly got paid?
They got paid because the money that they got paid as Astra Holdings, yeah. So Astra Holdings got the money from the South Africans, which was obviously less than 50 million. You know, they bought them from the South Africans. They sold them on to the British government. The 50 million quid was then distributed to Astra Holdings people, including the Tory party, but they'd obviously paid less for it to the South Africans. And I understand what happened was that they gathered together all the top Tory fundraisers and said, look, there's a plant chance to make some money here, do you want to come in on this? And a lot of them didn't really know what they were getting into, they just put their money up. We had Andrew Feinstein on the show some weeks ago, who's one of the top experts on the arms trade.
Well, he's just written a book called The Shadow World, yes, which is the first book on the global arms trade really for 25 years.
Yes, and he also used to be an ANC MP in South Africa, and he was saying that he has got the same information that we've got, that this is indeed what may well have happened.
Yeah, but you know what may be going on here is it all may be from the one dodgy source.
Well, this source is also in touch with our intelligence services, and I've actually checked out everything. I've been speaking to this guy, as you have, for the last 2 years, and everything he's said that I've been able to check out checks out. And I think if people want to check this, there's two people who are following this up in the blogosphere. One is Gordon Duff on Veterans Today. The other is Peter Eyre, E-Y-R-E, and he's been on Press TV and also the Palestine Telegraph.
Well, this is the sort of thing which the Iranians are bound to love, whether it's true or not.
The Iranians have run with this story on Press
TV. But, I mean, they're bound to do that, aren't they, whether it's true or not?
Well, no, because ultimately if Press TV runs mischievous, scurrilous stories, they will lose their credibility. But in actual fact, a lot of this does check out. And if you think about the links between the Tory party and the far right in South Africa and the kind of arms deals that they were doing, do you remember Mark Thatcher? Do you remember, what's his name, Simon Mann, who was arrested in Zimbabwe for carrying out a coup in Equatorial Guinea? Think about those connections and it all starts to make a lot of sense.
So does this mean that ultimately David Cameron could end up himself in jail?
Yes. Is a simple answer. The Nuclear Explosions Act of 1998 was passed at the behest of the British intelligence services when Labour came to power, and it says that if any of these bombs goes off, any British person who's shown to be associated with this in any way gets a mandatory life sentence, and that is a sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the Tory party leadership put in place by the British secret services. That's how serious this is.
Well, very interesting. What about, I mean, we've talked about the Tory party, money for the Tory party here. What is the, I mean, we really should call them the Conservatives, but where is the origin of this name, the Tory?
It's interesting. The word Tory, originally, the Tories were originally a notorious gangster clan that lived on Tory Island off the north coast of Northern Ireland, and they were famous robbers and
what period of history are we talking about?
We're talking about the 18th century, and so the Whig opponents of the Tory party called them the Tories because they saw them as a bunch of thieves and ne'er-do-wells, and it was basically the name stuck. So and has become somewhat neutral in subsequent years, but it was originally a nasty name that they were called, which they adopted as a badge of pride.
Okay, now also there's been Middle East mayhem, as I said at the top of the hour, with massive coordinated bomb attacks in Iraq and Syria this week, Martin. First of all, Iraq. I mean, we've had last week President Obama announcing that the last US troops, allegedly, I mean, even though they're leaving mercenaries behind and lots of troops to do training inside Iraq, leave, and then all of a sudden a massive bomb attack, something like 60 people killed, coordinated explosions right across the capital. And so what on earth future is there for a country like this? I mean, we're supposed to have moved in there, brought democracy, but as soon as these troops are moving out, you've got a massive bomb attack. And I think the other question is, I mean, what kind of factions outside or inside Iraq might be behind it?
Well, that's a very big speculation. Let's just point out the linkages between Syria and Iraq. The current regime in Iraq, which was kind of elected, although there are questions about that, about their legitimacy, but they've got the al-Sadr's people inside their coalition, so you know, who are very anti-American. They are aligned with Assad in Syria because the Alawite minority in Syria are Shiites, and they're aligned with Iran. Iraq is actually a swing state in all of this, so the Americans may indeed, by invading Iraq, and the British as well, have put in power a pro-Iranian regime, which is going to make attacks on Iran and Syria that much more difficult, because the Iraqis refuse to get involved in this Arab League delegation to Syria, for example. And many people, like the Christian minority in Iraq, fled to Syria because Syria was a nice, stable place. It's not a nice, stable place anymore. Syria is being Iraqized, and you're going to have similar sectarian conflict in Syria as you're probably going to get in Iraq. I mean, where these bombs went off, I'm not sure, but there's been attacks on Shia mosques in Iraq, which are being carried out presumably by Sunni insurgents who are being supported by Jordan, Saudi Arabia.
But there are big questions about who is actually planting these bombs.
Indeed, I mean, it could very well be
when a car explodes. Indeed, exactly. It's not necessarily a car bomb. It could be someone, as we've heard from a friend of ours who is here, living here in Bristol, going backwards and forwards to Iraq, that cars were stopped, checked by security forces, and when people got back into the cars, they found that bombs had been planted within the car.
Well, look back to the incident with the two SAS guys who were arrested at the roadblock in Basra years ago. The local police stopped them at the roadblock. They were in Arab dress. They shot their way through the roadblock, killing an Iraqi police officer. For their bad luck, they then ran round the corner into another Iraqi patrol. They were arrested. They were taken back, and the Iraqi police issued a statement saying these people were carrying weaponry and explosives. Now, where were the SAS going with explosives in Basra? Now, we never got to find out, because then the British Army stormed the police station, rescued the two guys, incidentally letting go of loads of insurgents which were being held by the Iraqi police. And people in Iraq quite openly say that the Western intelligence services are involved in bomb attacks in Iraq. We know they're involved in bomb attacks in Iran. They're supporting Jundullah, they're supporting MEK, they're supporting the Kurdish Party of Peace and Life, or whatever it's called. So all of the terrorist groups inside Iran that are fighting the regime are being supported by the West. They're assassinating nuclear scientists and so on. Basically, in the rest of the world, the Western powers are regarded as terrorist regimes. We don't think so because we're not told so, and we don't believe it, but everybody else believes it, and they're right.
But if we go back to this time last year, or a year ago now, there was a horrendous bomb attack in Egypt, wasn't there, at one of the most important mosques, and that
wasn't
turned out...
It wasn't a mosque, it was a Coptic Christian cathedral in Alexandria, and then it turned out that it was, in fact, the Mukhabarat trying to stir up trouble between the Muslims and the Christians.
And it was actually organised, allegedly anyway, by the actual interior minister. That is to say, the Home Secretary in Egypt had sent a team of people in to plant this bomb. Now, we are being told that these are sectarian problems, but actually it does seem that there may well be elements of the government themselves involved in planting these
bombs. And the Western
bombs.
Intelligence Services in Italy, in Turkey, the top leadership of the Turkish armed forces are currently on trial for engaging in exactly this kind of false flag terrorism. The Ergonikon network, which was well dug into the Turkish armed forces, and don't forget, the Turkish armed forces are an integral part of NATO. Their chaps are all trained at Sandhurst. So what do you think they were doing? They were planting bombs and saying it was this lot. They were planting bombs, they're saying it was the Grey Wolves, it was the right wing, it was the left wing. What they were doing was actually manipulating the population by using terrorism. And it's happened inside Western Europe and the Gladio network. We've covered that in previous shows. The Western intelligence services are no worse and no better than all the other intelligence services, and they all engage in this kind of dirty tricks activity.
Yeah, being this, the whole business of sectarianism reminds me of Northern Ireland, where I lived for a while, and we have the headlines on the Irish World this week, the voice of the Irish community in Britain, which is Truth But Is It Justice? Now it says here, the evidence of some collusion by the RUC police force in the north of Ireland in the 1975 murders of members of the Miami Show Band has been found by a cold case review team investigating the case. Now, what was this Miami Show Band murder? Because one of the things that they're pointing out in here, that the people that killed these, there was a roadblock set up, all with people in uniform, but those uniforms had actually been pinched from the Royal Ulster Constabulary, so it looked like an official roadblock. What it actually was a loyalist terrorist roadblock.
But at the same time, as the report shows, three of those people were currently serving members of the Ulster Defence Regiment, and one of them was an RUC informant. And the main point of the article is that the RUC informant, this guy was a senior loyalist terrorist and was working for the police all along. A guy called Brigadier Gordon Kerr, then Colonel Gordon Kerr, was at that time running something called the Force Research Unit based in Northern Ireland, which was basically uncovered by Sir John Stevens' investigation to be orchestrating and directing the loyalist terror campaign. And Brigadier Gordon Kerr disappeared to China, and then he's popped up. The last we heard of him, it's all been covered by Ian Mackay and the Glasgow Herald. He popped up in Iraq, running something called the Joint Services Group. Goodness knows what that is. But so I suspect he's got something to do with SAS boys running around with explosives in Basra.
The modus operandi here seems to be that there are elements within the security forces, whether it be police or else the military, who are actually planting bombs. I mean, this is certainly this whole business.
Or carrying out atrocities of one kind and another.
Yes. And then using that against one side or another side of a possible sectarian, really in order to try and spark a sectarian uprising, really, between two parts
of
society.
Well, it's just divide and rule, isn't it? Divide and rule. And the Western powers have been engaged in this kind of game for a very long time.
But what about the headline there on the Irish World, that he's saying the truth is coming out, but there's no justice?
Well, that's because there's not been a proper peace and reconciliation process in Northern Ireland. In fact, as things stand, those people should be prosecuted. That's what the historical inquiries team, it's a police service of Northern Ireland historical inquiries team that's looking into this. And basically the people involved should be prosecuted. But of course, if they are brought to book, they're going to say, well, we did it on the orders of Brigadier Gordon Kerr, call him back from Iraq and have him put in prison. But they're not going to be put in prison, these people, because they're above the law.
It's a bit like the bankers, isn't it?
Yes.
They seem to have impunity.
And in fact, there's very strong linkages between the intelligence services and certain banks. Hambro's Bank in the City of London was long known as a front for MI6, but Bank of Credit and Commerce International was set up, crashed eventually, but was set up as a means for intelligence services to do what they do and for lots of drug money to be washed. That's what goes on in the financial services.
Well, let's wind up by looking at this bomb attack today. More than 30 dead in Damascus bombings. The bombings which official blamed on Al-Qaeda were the first attacks against Syria's powerful security services in the heart of the capital since the uprising began, and overshadowed new protests against President Bashar al-Assad's regime. One bomber tried to ram a vehicle packed with explosives into the compound of the General Security Directorate, Syria's most important plainclothes security service, in the Kfar Sush neighbourhood of Damascus, witnesses said. A second blew up a vehicle outside a nearby military intelligence building. This is all happening on the first day after the arrival of Arab observers. Apparently, according to the foreign minister, this is the gift we get from the terrorists and Al-Qaeda, but we are going to do all we can to facilitate the Arab League mission in Syria, he said. Mikhad was accompanied to the bomb site by Arab League Assistant General Secretary Samir Saif al-Yazal, head of the observer mission's advanced team, which flew in on Thursday.
Well, I mean, you shouldn't jump to conclusions when an incident like this happens. This could be the insurgents trying to make a point. It could be the Syrian intelligence services trying to make themselves look good by blowing up their own building. That's the kind of thing you have to... That's in the Middle East, people think like this. Nobody presumes they know exactly what's happening. Don't presume that there's good guys and bad guys. When I was an aid worker in Bosnia during the war, one of the things I realised is that everybody's bad guys. There are no good guys, and they all hate each other.
Well, the state news agency SANA, S-A-N-A, said on Thursday that more than 2,000 security force personnel in Syria have been killed in attacks over the last few months by armed rebels. Now, this doesn't sound like a sort of Egypt-style uprising, does it?
No, and the Egyptians should take notice. The only way to get any help from the West is to pick up guns and start shooting policemen, isn't it? That's the message we're sending. In actual fact, most of the insurgency in Syria seems to be just on the Jordanian border, where I understand US Marines have arrived, and just on the Turkish border. And then the centre of the town, the centre of the country in Damascus, has been relatively quiet, but not now, because a big bomb's gone off at the secret police headquarters. I don't know what happened, Tony. Even if you were there, you wouldn't know what happened. But people out there in Radio Land, don't presume you know what happened, and don't believe the BBC's spin on things, because they've got as much of an agenda as anybody else.
Well, thank you, Martin, for that beautiful link, because we're talking about the BBC and BBC Radio Bristol specifically after some music.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there.
cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men, the shooting goes. Washington bullets again, as every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad. Those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy and the Cuban Sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets won Castro dead. For Castro is the color. Of lead. Sandinista. For the very first time ever, when they had a revolution in Nicaragua, there was no interference from America. For the leader and up he flew. With the Washington bullet, what else could he do? If we can find an Afghan rebel that the Moscow bullets missed, ask him what he thinks of voting communist. Ask the Dalai Lama in the hills of Tibet, how many monks did the Chinese get in a war-torn swamp? Stop any mercenary and check the British bullets in his armory.
Clash from their double album Sandinista. Oh, actually, I think it was a triple album, if I remember rightly, originally when it was vinyl. Sandinista. Martin, who were the Sandinistas?
The Sandinistas were a liberation movement in Nicaragua, the Front Sandinista per Liberación Nacional.
This is in the 1980s. North end of South America or Central America.
It's
actually
in Central America, yeah. And they came to power through an armed revolt, like in Libya, but much more genuine than the one in Libya, I think. They then immediately had an election, which they won. The US wouldn't accept that, and then began a terrorist campaign against the country. They won a second election in 1984, and that didn't make any difference to the US attitude. And after 30, 40,000 civilians had been killed, eventually the Sandinistas were forced from power. That's how much the United States values democracy.
Okay, the Contra. Now, that rings a few bells with the Iran-Contra scandal.
Indeed, because yes.
I remember Oliver North, this fantastically good-looking US soldier, giving some sort of testimony, basically saying that the American military had been running massive amounts of drugs.
Well, he didn't admit that, although the Senator Kerry's committee that was investigating it did uncover most of the relevant facts. They were funding this terrorist campaign campaign, because you still had a Democrat Congress in that era, and the Reagan administration wanted to fund the Contras, and they went to the Democrat Congress, and the Democrat Congress said, well, no, we expressly forbid you to fund the Contras because that gives us a bad reputation all around the world, this kind of thing. So the Reagan administration immediately solved that problem by setting up a massive drugs run into the United States using MENA Air Base, mainly in Arkansas, and funding the Contras from cocaine profits. And that's all on the record. It was uncovered by Mike Rupert, the head of the Los Angeles Police Department's anti-narcotics squad. All of these things are on the record, but they're not covered in the mainstream media. And of course, if you say something like the American government's been heavily involved in drug smuggling, can you imagine what a BBC presenter would... Can you imagine the face on Paxman? Really? Really? You can imagine the kind of face they would put on, but the fact is, it's on the record. They've been involved in massive drug dealing all along. For many, many years.
There was a journalist I remember called Gary Webb who looked into a lot of this kind of thing, and then he met a bit of a sticky end.
Yes, he shot himself back twice in the back of the head, as you do, if you missed because you missed the first time.
But with the Iran-Contra, what actually happened to all these people? I mean, did Ollie North actually do time
No, no. What happened with all these people is they became part of the... They all signed something called the Project for a New American Century. And if you actually look at the cast list of Iran-Contra and the cast list in the Bush administration, it's exactly the same. Dick Cheney, Elliot Abrahams, Richard Armitage, John Poindexter, they're all there. They're all the same people. And I think they should have gone to prison in the 1980s. They didn't. They came back to power. And that's why you have things like 9/11 happening and the invasion of Iraq and so on. They are gangsters. And when I say that, I mean that they've all got Interpol files. They have. But whether Interpol can do anything about them is another matter.
Well, we seem to be coming back to this theme again and again this evening, you know, as to whether actual criminals, high-level criminals, are actually ever going to go to jail.
Well, it's what they call in Latin America impunidad, impunity. And the laws are there, but they're only for the little people. The big people don't have to obey the law. And that's, I'm afraid, the situation that we're in. The overmighty subjects have captured the state apparatus.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, a bit closer to home, audience research company Rajar announced in October this year that Radio Bristol had lost half of their listeners in a year. The actual figures are for reach within the area where BBC Radio Bristol can be picked up and are expressed in percentage of terms of people within that area that listen at least once a week. In October 2010, the figure was 2011, the figure was 8.4%, but in October 2011 it had dropped to 4.2%, which means only half of you were listening. That really is a disastrous result for manager Tim Pemberton, but to a certain extent his hands are tied by managers over him. So what's gone wrong? Now, can I just ask, Polly Winch is still with us. Polly, do you ever listen to BBC Radio Bristol?
To be honest, I've maybe listened to like a tiny bit, but no, not really.
And what about you, Martin? You ever heard the local radio station,
not
BBC?
Not really, no. It's a simple answer to that question.
Okay, so why is that? But you first, Polly.
I don't know. I suppose I presume that it might be quite boring.
Well, yes, possibly. But, I mean, the idea is, I mean, do you think there's a sort of change in the way that people are listening? I mean, certainly in my generation, when we were growing up, there'd be just the three or four radio stations around, two or three TV channels. Things have massively multiplied, and now also we've got the internet, haven't we?
Yeah, I think that's probably the main reason. I get most of my news and entertainment from the internet, and I quite rarely really listen to the radio at all. And I also think there's something to be said for the fact that it feels like there is less of a sort of community feeling now than perhaps there was sort of when I was a kid. So feeling less kind of connected, or, you know, with Bristol or with kind of the local area.
Well, I do listen to Radio Bristol a fair bit. I mean, quite often in the mornings.
Oh, you sad man.
Well, I mean, it's quite often in the mornings. So if I'm pottering around, I'll have a listen. I don't hear many local accents on there. There's a few more. Certainly not a lot of ethnic minorities, even though Bristol's... I don't know if there's any actual ethnic minority programmes. Maybe one in an afternoon,
Tim Pemberton
late in the evening.
Is an ethnic minority,
yes,
is
but
he
he's
not?
Actually not on the air. He's the station manager. So, you know, I do question that particularly. I mean, I'd certainly like to hear some some of the, either from some people from the West Indian Somali community or whatever on during the day. And the guy that produces that presents the breakfast show, it sounds like he's from Northern Ireland. I'm not sure. Certainly not a lot of local accents.
Not from round here, then.
Apart from Steve Yabsley. Now he's fantastic. Steve Yabsley's a sort of jokey character that's been around for quite a while. He used to do Saturday mornings. Now he's on all the time, every weekday. He's definitely got a local accent, but it's kind of, he's talking about trivia and it's a kind of jokey show. The breakfast show, as I said, it seems to be sort of a bit too corporate. Now, Martin, I wonder what your thoughts are about the way the BBC's been going over the last, I suppose, 20 years. It was set up originally as a public service broadcaster, and it seems to be becoming a bit more corporate, doesn't it? Do you think that's just inevitable? Well, because that's the landscape they're now operating in?
At national level, they get swept up into this celebrity culture thing, and they're in competition with Sky and what have you. At local level, I think part of the problem is that people it's too local for my, I mean, I don't listen to it because I'm not really that interested in just getting a local view about local things. I mean, this is a local radio station we're on now, but as you know, the conception behind this show is it's a view of the world from Bristol, rather than just a view of Bristol looking at its own.
Yeah, I mean,
navel.
My problem is that most of the stuff out there, in fact, all of the coverage of national news and international news is from London. Everything, the regional news will cover some, local stories, etc. But I mean, the Manchester Guardian, the Guardian newspaper, originally started in Manchester as a national newspaper based in the regions, and that's one of the reasons that I quite like the idea that regional cities can have a national and international view too. So what are your thoughts, Polly, about this whole business of celebrities? Is it something that attracts you at all as a young person? You know, because the BBC have kind of got a campaign to have celebrities on so that people will watch.
Yeah, I mean, I used to kind of read a lot of celebrity magazines and watch a lot of celebrity programmes, and I don't know, sort of, then I got more interested in what I felt was really going on. But I'm not sure how much of it is, we're giving the people what they want, or actually are you kind of manufacturing what the people want? Actually, perhaps if you did put other things on, people might watch that and become interested in different, perhaps more interesting things than who's getting off with who or who's the best dancer from EastEnders or whatever.
Yeah, the other thing which frustrates me is that they're always talking about themselves. It's always such and such a BBC programme, because I imagine because that they're, on the next corridor there's someone who's making a wildlife show, there's quite a lot of discussion about things that are actually on the telly, rather than going out and being proactive. And another part of this is that journalism itself, I mean, it obviously is programme side of things, which is during the day, and the news, which is done by journalists. A lot of journalism now is just simply press releases and public relations companies saying, putting a bit of spin on something. What are your thoughts, Martin, about that particular side of things? Because this does determine the direction of any kind of media. Is it something that we're actually proactively going out to seek stories, or are we waiting for them to turn up as faxes and emails from corporations?
Well, also a certain narrative is allowed to develop, which means that if you start talking about things that are outside the narrative sweep of the normal run-of-the-mill discussion, it's like you're talking in Babelfish and people can't understand what you're talking about. We frequently, for example, talk about false flag terrorism on this show. It's a perfectly straightforward concept. It's the sort of thing that happened in Northern Ireland for years, and of course if you're in Belfast, people understand what you're talking about. But I tell you what, in some parts of Britain people are really nonplussed because they've never had these kind of basic concepts explained to them.
Now, you talked about false flag terrorism as something which is from a film, wasn't it? Some kind of where you're hoisting the wrong flag on one of these old ships.
It's originally an 18th century naval term, and Captain Cochrane, who was the hero of Master and Commander, was famous for this. He would run up, say he was sailing towards French ships, he'd fly a French flag so they'd think he was French, and then as soon as he got alongside, he'd open fire and achieve it, what he was trying to do. But I mean, I'm just using that as a for example. There's no reason why local radio should be trivial. And I think that the if you're going to talk to people in a trivial way, and this is only local trivial things, nothing important, then I think you get the kind of audience you deserve, and it dwindles away. There's no reason why people in Bristol should be any less switched on to what's going on in the world at large than anybody else. And local radio ought to reflect the fact that this city is actually quite a switched-on city. But if you talk down to people and you can constantly, spoon-feed them with what human interest stories and so on, people will turn off because it's just not exciting enough.
Okay, Polly, what about for you? give Tim Pemberton a leg up here and tell him, what should Radio Bristol, BBC Radio Bristol, be doing to actually bring in a larger audience? I mean, actually losing half your audience in a year is a bit of a catastrophe, really. So something's got to change. As a young person, what would you like to see if you were in his shoes?
I agree with Martin. I think, I mean, I've noticed with the BBC, even the national news, you know, it's patronising, and I feel like they don't really kind of credit us with the intelligence that we have. So I suppose, yeah, make things, you know, go more in depth into things. Look at things that are happening outside of Bristol as well as things that are happening in Bristol, because I think that's important too. But yeah, I mean, kind of raise the bar a little bit, you know, and give the public some credit, because we're not idiots and we don't need spoon feeding.
What about this whole thing of being happy? Because this is one of the things that, you know, everyone is being told. I mean, we've talked about some pretty grim stuff tonight, but we're not grim about it, really. There seems to be a sort of pressure for everyone to be sort of almost smiling as they're talking the whole time. And that's that worries me. Is there anything we can do about that, do you think? Or anything that Tim can do to sort of get away from that kind of fake smile form of media?
Well, I suppose just start being a bit more real about things, you know. Don't be under pressure to kind of put across any sort of persona. And I think this is one of the things, and we were talking about it earlier in the break with politicians, is there's this pressure, kind of, if I say this in the wrong way, then people are going to pick it apart. And I think that fear really needs to go, and people need to just start expressing what they think.
I think in general terms, what we try and do on this show, Polly, is we try and talk in a serious tone of voice. And we have people here politically very different from myself, for example, but we very rarely get people leaving unhappy, because we actually talk in a reasonable tone of voice about serious things in a serious way. And actually, people out there are quite hungry for that. They don't want to be talked down to, and they don't want to be jollied along. The situation is very serious, and the politicians in the city have got to talk to each other in a respectful way. There's bound to be differences. That's what politics is about. Look at the way people talk to each other in Northern Ireland, for example, where they've been very recently organising to kill each other, but they talk to each other in a very reasonable tone of voice, and they come to agreements. That's the way we've got to run our politics on this side of the water as well.
Well, on the positive side, I have to say that we've got Keith Warmington on there and Trevor Fry, both really good presenters, very warm, very genuine people, but they're on a sort of graveyard slot, aren't they, later in the evenings.
You would know, too, because we don't listen to graveyard slots.
Well,
we've got
do.
Better things
you know,
to
I
do
I
with
do,
our
I
time.
Anyway, the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee scrutinised the BBC annual report every year, and they did so again a couple of weeks ago. Here's Conservative MP Philip Davis quizzing the BBC's Director General, and this is from London, not from here in Bristol, Mark Thompson.
Mr. Thompson, can I ask you if you have any idea at all in any recent opinion polls, there's one out today in The Sun, from carried out by YouGov, what the proportion of people are that believe that Britain should leave the European Union?
Well, as we know, that's a fast-moving story.
Ballpark figure. What sort of percentage of the population think
Britain
should leave the
EU? Let's see when we see a number of polls after the event of last week, where we are afterwards. Before, though, clearly, it's been a significant proportion.
Well, the Daily Politics did a poll about a year ago, I think it was about 50%.
There are many polls showing around 50%. Okay.
So how much of the coverage of the Europe that the BBC does should include contributors that believe that Britain should withdraw from the European Union?
I think that in common with every other public policy debate and political debate in this country, there should be a significant representation.
So if I was to say that between September and December 2010, according to Newswatch, which is headed up by somebody who worked for the BBC for 7 years, the percentage of withdrawalists, so to speak, on the BBC was 1.9%. Between March and June 2011, it was 0.5%. And between October and December 2011, it was 1.6%. What? Do you think those figures are acceptable?
I don't know if you've ever yourself get a chance to watch or listen to what we do, but if you've been listening to or watching the BBC in recent days, you couldn't have helped to see an extraordinarily rich coverage, in my view, good coverage of the story, including any number of people whose very strong views, and there are many forms I know of Euroscepticism, absolutely include those who believe there are many people who've been on the air when this has become a very big story, as it has in recent weeks and months.
That was the BBC's Director General Mark Thompson there, talking to Conservative MP Philip Davis about their coverage of Europe. And also a former Conservative minister who was removed at the polls by voters is now chairman of the BBC Trust. That's Chris Patton. He's also a former unelected EU commissioner too, as well as and so Conservative MP Philip Davis pointed out, clutching a copy at this same Culture, Media and Sport Committee meeting last week, clutching a copy of the Mail on Sunday.
My job, if I may say so, is to ensure that the BBC, which most people seem to think it is, remains fair and balanced in its reporting of what happens in the world.
You were, in answer to Tom Watson, you were saying how important lack of conflicts of interest were in reporting. You get a pension from the European Union as being a commissioner.
I get a pension from this house as well.
Is it true that your pension from the European Commission is forfeitable?
No.
It's not true. So when...
As we've made clear, when Lord Pearson of Rannoch has made that charge in the House
of
Lords...
Well, funnily enough...
In his own balanced and impartial and fair and accurate way.
Actually, that was Chris Patton, who's chairman of the BBC Trust, defending robustly his fact that he gets a pension from the European Union, and yet he can still be an independent board member. Now, finally, Martin, we're going to go on to sum up tonight by talking about the Fox Werity scandal. Just in a nutshell, we had some stuff from Craig Murray, the blogger and former Uzbekistan ambassador, about this. What was it? Who was this Werity character?
Well, we don't really know, but it's quite clear that he's got very strong links to wealthy, very wealthy people with a very strong Zionist political background. And the same goes for the ambassador to Israel. And as Craig Murray pointed out, in the past it has been a standard procedure that the ambassador to Israel should not be Jewish in case there should be conflicts of interest. This ambassador is not only Jewish, he's very on the record as being very pro the Israeli position. And in fact, it's rather inappropriate for a British diplomat.
But surely it's the best way, because Israel is actually a democracy, isn't it?
Well, in the same kind of way as Russia's a democracy. We were talking about this earlier. I mean, there are degrees and degrees of democracy. Also, Israel is in occupation of other people's territory, as Serbia was debatably in the 1990s.
Now, Werity was in the Ministry of Defence, a very, very sensitive department to do with national security. And when David Cameron was asked clearance. When he was asked about this, David Cameron refused to actually guarantee that there weren't other Werities in other departments.
Well, the fact of the matter is, we were talking earlier about this secret group, Astra Holdings, buying nuclear weapons. But basically, they're on the inside track of what the British foreign policy establishment is up to, and they use that knowledge in order to make personal deals and profits. And Werity would be one of the gophers, just as Cameron was such a gopher when he went to South Africa in the early 90s.
Allegedly. Anyway, that's all.
He definitely went. The question is what he did when he got there.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because after Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 7, Friday night is Music Night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest, politics graduate with a Master's in International Political Economy from Warwick, Polly Winch, and also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week for New Year, we discuss more of the week and the year's big stories with an exclusive interview with one of the country's leading authors of Masonic exposés inside the Brotherhood. So until then, goodbye for now from me, Tony Gosling.
BCFM.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.